Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Researchers say they've made a dramatic new advance in the fight against breast cancer. A study released today in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that when the drug Herceptin is given to women with the most aggressive tumors, they are half as likely as those who don't take the drug to have the disease recur within 2 years following standard chemotherapy. Dr. Harold Burstein of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston was involved in the study. He wrote the commentary that accompanies the article and joins us now on the line. Welcome, doctor.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
And how important is this finding?
These are very exciting data. We have been able to take a novel drug and, as you just said in your introduction, cut the risk of recurrence in half for what had previously been a very virulent form of breast cancer.
And your colleague, Dr. Richard Gelber, said it's probably the biggest evidence of a treatment effect he's ever seen in oncology.
Yes, the only thing that comes close in breast cancer medicine is the use of anti-estrogen therapy, which is also about able to reduce the risk by about 50% in women who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And this is a similar benefit with the Herceptin, about a 50% risk reduction.
Well, you wrote in your commentary that this study also tells us that not all breast cancers are the same. So let's explain that some more. We understand that the drug Herceptin is effective for treating women whose tumors are HER2 positive, which means they overproduce a protein associated with the most aggressive forms of cancer.
That's exactly right. You know, we're increasingly learning that not all breast cancers are the same. There are probably four major types of breast cancer, of which HER2-positive breast cancer is one specific type. It affects about 15 to 20% of all women with breast cancer. And this new drug, Herceptin, is an antibody that recognizes this protein, binds to it on the tumor cell, and causes the cell to behave better.
Well, then, doctor, how easy is it to find out whether a patient has that kind of tumor that will respond to the Herceptin?
It's relatively straightforward. The pathologists perform tests on the tumor tissue after the patient has had a biopsy, and that's now a standard part of the evaluation for all women with newly diagnosed breast cancer.
Well, and you know, women are wary of a magic pill. As you know, most powerful drugs have side effects. So what are the side effects of Herceptin?
Absolutely. They're right to be concerned. And the unusual side effect unique to Herceptin is the risk of heart damage from this drug. This drug is not chemotherapy, so it doesn't make people sick to their stomach and it doesn't make their hair fall out and things like that. But it can, in rare cases, be damaging to the heart muscle. So 4% of the women who were treated with this drug and chemotherapy did develop symptoms of heart failure. Obviously, one of the things we want to do next is to figure out who is at risk for that side effect and how we can avoid it so that women can safely get this medication.
Mm. And, you know, you mentioned the chemotherapy. I wanted to ask you a question about how you do a study like this, because it has to be closely tied to other procedures like chemotherapy, correct?
Absolutely. And there actually have now been four randomized clinical trials looking at chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy plus this new drug, Herceptin. They've all shown remarkably consistent results. And the next generation of studies will have to determine, is there an optimal chemo backbone and how exactly should you integrate the drug with chemotherapy?
Hmm. Well, you know, and if there's been any criticism, the little criticism we've seen is that some of the women in the study who didn't take the Herceptin received the results of the study in a letter and, of course, came to realize, geez, they were that much farther away from their chemotherapy treatment and they hadn't had the Herceptin.
You know, it's always awkward when data come along that truly change treatment practice overnight.
Mm-hmm.
For the patients who are on this clinical trials, the standard of care was chemotherapy. So all the women who were on the study got, at a minimum, what was thought to be strongly the standard of care.
And what should women do now if they're further away from their initial diagnosis and chemotherapy treatment? Should they still talk to their doctors about Herceptin?
I think for women who have been very recently diagnosed and are still receiving chemotherapy or who are in the immediate weeks or months after their chemotherapy, it is worth talking to your doctor about whether to add Herceptin. Again, it only relates to women who have HER2-positive tumors.
Mm-hmm.
And for most such women, these data have been internalized and we're already talking to them about it. For women who are further out from treatment, the good news is that they have hopefully not had a recurrence. The drug is available should they have a recurrence. There are no data that it should be added sort of routinely to women who finished chemo, say, 6, 12, 20 months ago.
And will insurance cover Herceptin?
Undoubtedly, it will. I think that the FDA approval for the drug in the early stage setting is still pending, so there may be some minor administrative pieces to it, but undoubtedly this will be covered by standard insurance.
Dr. Harold Burstein from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute on today's paper on the positive results of Herceptin in treating certain forms of breast cancer in women. Doctor, thanks very much.
A pleasure to be with you.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is in Washington today, meeting with President Bush for the first time since Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. The visit comes at a time of growing unrest in Gaza. The militant group Hamas has claimed credit for Israel's withdrawal, saying it was armed resistance, not the peace process, that caused Israel to leave after more than 30 years. And this week, a Hamas leader said Israel should not be surprised if it faces a new wave of suicide bombings because of Israeli settlers still in the West Bank. Well, Salah Abdel Shafi is a Palestinian living in Gaza City. He works as an economic and management consultant. And Mr. Shafi, we spoke to you several months ago as Israel was in the process of pulling out. How has your life changed since then?
The fact that Israel is not there anymore makes life much easier. Sometimes, you know, the Gaza Strip is a very small area. It's just, you know, 40 kilometers long and 12 kilometers wide. But sometimes it was impossible to move, from one town to the other town, from one city to the other city. For example, if I wanted to go for business purposes, just 10 kilometers away from where my office is located, this was impossible. Or I used to go to make a business visit and then spend 10 hours, sometimes more, because I was not able to come back because of Israeli checkpoints and restrictions on movements. So definitely now things are much easier. But in general, with regard to movement from the Gaza Strip to the outside world, nothing has changed. Israel is still controlling all access points from the Gaza Strip to the outside world.
Well, when we spoke last, you said you feared that if Israel didn't do more to open the border, Gaza would turn into something of a prison. Are you feeling that?
Yes, unfortunately, this is what is happening today. Israel turned practically Gaza into a big prison. Movement is pretty much restricted. People cannot leave the Gaza Strip. So really, what we gained from this disengagement, from this Israeli withdrawal, is internal movement. But in terms of leaving the Gaza Strip, nothing has changed. To the contrary, I think things got worse because basically when Israel abandoned the Gaza-Egyptian borders, now these borders are closed, completely closed. And people cannot go in and out.
Well, Salah, how much are Palestinians in part responsible for that? Because Israel has said that it's had to stop negotiations and stop more opening because of the increased violence. And we do hear reports of kidnappings, sporadic gunshots, different Palestinian militant factions jockeying for control. Do you feel that violence? Do you feel that increased fighting for power?
Yes, sure. I mean, we do feel this. We know that the security situation is still very fragile. You see, after 5 years of intifada, it's kind of a low-intensity war. Central institutions of the Palestinian Authority are not functioning well. There are many armed groups. Now, I think it's going to take time until the Palestinian Authority will be able to have full control. So there is domestic, there is internal violence going on. But I think this violence is related to the fact that poverty rates are still very high, people are unemployed, people cannot go about, you know, their lives in a normal way. And that's why we think if Israel facilitates the movement of the people, if there is normality and economic prosperity, then there will be no chance for violence. Violence flourishes In poverty and economic crisis.
Well, and some would say also when there's a lack of leadership. Do you blame President Abbas for the violence? Do you think he's the right man?
I think he is definitely the right man. I think President Abbas made several times very clear that he is genuine about pursuing a peaceful path about resuming peace negotiations with Israel. He clearly stated that he's against violence, that he will disarm militant troops, that there should only be one authority, and this is the authority of the government and the security forces. But at the same time, we have to give, the world community has to give President Abbas a chance, has to support President Abbas, and I think Israel, above all, should be supportive to President Abbas by really facilitating the life of Palestinians and not turning the life of Palestinians into hell.
Well, you are an economic consultant, so you're the guy to ask. You mentioned poverty and work. What are people in Gaza doing for work? Have different jobs increased? Has there been a change since the Israelis left?
No, not at all. You see, simply because people cannot move. We can't expect, really, it's not only the movement of individuals is restricted, it's the movement of individuals and goods is pretty much restricted.
Well, with all of this going on, there's an election coming up. Right now there's some confusion about the timing. It was set for December 15th, right? But the Palestinian Authority is now saying they may postpone voting in Gaza City and other Hamas strongholds.
Yes.
But what do you think, if elections were held today or in the very near future, would Hamas win?
No, I don't think that Hamas will gain the majority. Definitely Hamas will be one of the main political powers, but definitely Hamas will not be the dominating political power. Again, Hamas benefits from a situation of instability, from a situation of poverty and unemployment. You cannot combat Hamas with only security and military means. What is needed, we need to prove to the people that a peaceful path will lead to economic prosperity, will lead to creating jobs. And here Israel can help. That's why the outcome of the elections depends largely on how things evolve on the ground, whether there is going to be prosperity and economic development, whether people will see hope in the future. If this doesn't happen, then I'm afraid the chances of Hamas to become the major political power will increase.
Salah Abdel Shafi is a Palestinian living in Gaza City. Well, we want to turn now to Matt Rees, Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. And Matt, we're going to get out our roadmap to peace and see where we are. But I just want to hear from you first. You were in Gaza last week. What are you hearing from Palestinians?
Well, as Salah Abdel Shafi was saying, yes, it is a better atmosphere. There's a feeling of what people say is that it's easier to breathe now. They can move around the Gaza Strip. But they can't leave the Gaza Strip. There was a brief few days when Hamas blew up the border and people went through in their droves, showing you how eager people are to get out of the Gaza Strip.
Well, of course, Israel is saying they'd be foolish to open up the borders more until some of these militant factions are controlled. Tell you what, Matt, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll speak to you more about where we are on this roadmap. Are we at stalemate? Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been looking at the Middle East. In today's Wall Street Journal, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas pens an opinion piece entitled, "Is the Roadmap at a Dead End?" Well, is it? Earlier today, President Abbas met with President Bush in Washington, D.C., as we said, the second meeting between the two men since President Abbas was elected in January, the first since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip. In a Rose Garden ceremony, President Bush called on Israel to suspend the construction of settlements in the West Bank. He also called on President Abbas to do more to stop attacks by militant groups such as Hamas.
The way forward must begin by confronting the threat that armed gangs pose to a genuinely democratic Palestine.
But in turn, Palestinian President Abbas called on President Bush to urge Israel to stop construction of its security barrier and do more to improve the lives of Palestinians.
Peace and security cannot be guaranteed by the construction of walls, by the erection of checkpoints, and the confiscation of land, but rather by the recognition of rights.
Well, we've been speaking with Matthew Rees. He's Time Magazine's Jerusalem Bureau Chief. And, Matt, it would seem there you have it. One side saying you've got to get rid of the gangs, the other side saying, but you've got to let us move first. And, of course, Israel saying we don't trust movement till you get rid of the gangs.
Yeah, it's a tough situation right now, Robin. The basics of what President Bush is saying there, though, are no surprise to President Abbas. That's the biggest problem he faces. It may seem strange from the outside, but it's not Hamas that are really giving him the trouble. It's his own Fatah organization, or disorganization, we should say, at the moment. They are the basis of these gangs who have had 5 years of intifada and violence in which they have essentially taken over their neighborhoods. And right now, he is trying to bring them back into the fold. It's difficult for him to do it, though, unless he offers them either jobs or money, and he doesn't really have a lot of either.
Right. And of course, we heard last week it got so bad that there was an open fight in public in the university, which had to be shut down.
Exactly. There's a lot of violence breaking out, whether it be kidnappings of foreign correspondents or foreign aid workers, which have been going on for some months, or some of his own policemen walked into Parliament a couple of weeks ago and fired in the air because they wanted to protest the fact that they were not being given the power to go out and arrest these gangsters from nominally the same organization. When you're on the ground in Gaza, what people are really concerned about right now is, yes, there's a good feeling from the Israelis having gone, but they're very worried that right now they are tipping into anarchy.
Mm. Well, does Mahmoud Abbas make a point that there might be some movement? He writes in today's Wall Street Journal, Gaza's airport and crossing point to Egypt remain closed. Its waters are off limits to our fishermen. Its borders are completely sealed, and movement into or out of Gaza virtually impossible. No safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank exists because investors rightly fear that without access to the outside world, Gazans will not be able to rebuild a functioning economy.
Well, the fear that Abbas and a lot of senior Palestinians have right now is that what Ariel Sharon did over the summer to leave the Gaza Strip is going to look like a step towards peace, but is actually, because it was a unilateral step, simply Israel pulling back to a position where it's easier for them to contain the Palestinians, where the Palestinians cannot do the Israelis much harm. And there is a certain amount of truth to that. What they really want now is for President Bush and his representatives to push hard so that Gaza, at least, if not the West Bank, can get some kind of economic recovery going. That's why he mentions the airport and the border crossing with Egypt. There's a real pent-up desire on ordinary Palestinians' parts to be able to come and go, not to feel like they're in the prison that you mentioned earlier.
But I want to stop you there.
More importantly, there's the economic aspect.
Yeah, and I want to stop you there, though, because and just ask you, yes, we're hearing about the economics, but of course Israel is saying, you know, there has to be more safety. I'm wondering, how much can Abbas do? We just heard from a Palestinian say, jobs first, then security will follow. Can he crack down any more than some of the Palestinian police have on Hamas and the Fatah factions and the other militant groups? I mean, what would happen if he did?
He has tried to confront Hamas at certain points, and it's resulted in gun battles for a couple of days. Over the course of the summer, there were several of these. He hasn't really gone against them full on because he doesn't have the support of his own security chiefs. His own security chiefs are very often either afraid of or in league with these local gangs, and that's his big weakness, is not the desire to crack down on them and to preserve calm, but the fact that the organization that he was left with when Yasser Arafat died in November is so riddled with corruption, and he hasn't been able to confront that as yet.
Well, and the West Bank, President Bush today called on Israel to stop the expansion of settlements there. Any sign that that's going to happen?
No, there's no sign that that's really on the cards, or that the fence, the barrier along the border, is going to be stopped. The Israeli public perceives that as having worked pretty well. What the Palestinians are really pushing for is the ability to move around the West Bank. That's what the World Bank says is the biggest hindrance to Palestinian business and to the emergence of ordinary Palestinians from poverty. But then again, they don't do themselves any favors there when there are shootings, as there were on the road, which the Israelis immediately closed down certain Palestinian towns. So that, in the coming weeks, is going to be a big battle between the two sides to try and get the roads open, not between the Palestinian areas and Jordan or neighboring countries or Israel, but just between Palestinian towns.
Matt Rees, Time Magazine's Jerusalem Bureau Chief, author of the book Cain's Field, Faith, Fratricide, and Fear in the Middle East. Under a minute, Matt. Is it just a matter of time? Or is there something major that has to happen to move out of this stalemate?
Well, it's a matter of time, if you believe what the Israeli politicians say, before Ariel Sharon actually turns around and does a little more of what he's already done, pulls out of some settlements in the West Bank.
I'm going to have to stop you there.
Full peace is going to take a long time.
A long time. I have to stop you there, Matt. And as always, we will check back with you. Matt Rees, Time Magazine, Jerusalem Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for your insight.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The latest federal statistics on racial profiling show that DWB, driving while black, is still a problem. The Justice Department found that while black, white, and Latino drivers were pulled over at the same rate, they were treated differently once stopped. Black and Latino drivers were searched more often. Police were more likely to issue tickets to Latinos, and officers were much more likely to arrest and use force against African-American drivers. So the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers is stepping in, offering workshops for blacks and Latinos on how to keep those interactions from becoming confrontations. Lieutenant Charles Wilson is a police officer who works at Rhode Island College. He's also president of the Rhode Island Minority Police Association and vice president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Welcome, Lieutenant.
Thank you.
Well, this is a switch of sorts, isn't it? Because usually workshops are given to train police officers to teach them how not to profile. This is for civilians, citizens. Are you saying that this is to tell citizens that they might be part of the problem? They might be provoking some of these statistics?
By no means. Mm-hmm. By no means. The workshops are, in fact, directed both towards citizens and law enforcement. We believe very strongly that people in the community need to know the process by which law enforcement officers go through. A lot of times people don't understand what a police officer is thinking or trying to accomplish when they do stop them, when they approach them on the street.
Mm. Okay. So this is about perhaps some understanding, some education on the part of citizens. And your email announcement caught our eye because it says participants can learn how to handle interactions with good and bad police while driving, while walking or standing on the street, and while at home. In other words, if we got this right, while being of color.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like it or not, racial profiling is alive and well.
Mm.
There are any number of law enforcement agencies in Rhode Island included, but across the country, who like to think that this is nothing more than a perceived phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
While it may well be perception, perception is 99% of fact.
So what are some of the things you're going to do? What are some of the workshops?
The workshop itself is very interactive. We do a lot of role play in this. We put citizens in the workshop scenarios. We put police officers in the workshop scenarios. We have them change roles.
Well, I was going to say, so what would they say? Let's say I'm the citizen, and I were playing the part of the cop. What would I say?
We might have you approach a sample vehicle and advise the person behind the wheel that they're being stopped for, let's say, a speeding violation. You would then go about the business of trying to obtain their driver information, trying to obtain their vehicle information, while all the time the person behind the wheel is being argumentative, asking a wide number of questions that you as a supposed law enforcement officer may not want to answer right now.
Right. So you give citizens a chance to feel how the cops might feel when they're just trying to do their jobs. What do you tell citizens about what not to do to provoke a problem after they've been pulled over if they are black or Latino?
Irregardless of who it is, white, black, and Latino are different. We tell people point blank, if you get stopped by the police, they think that they have a reason or probable cause to make that stop. Okay, so it's best that they remain quiet, and calm rather, identify themselves when they ask to do so. And in fact, the Supreme Court even says now that when a police officer asks you for identification, you must provide it. Okay, be very cognizant of your surroundings. Be very watchful of the officer's reactions to you. If it's at night, turn the interior light on in your car. Keep both hands in clear view. If you have to reach into your glove box to get information, such as your maybe you've got your wallet in there or your registration and insurance papers, tell the officer that's what you're doing. Okay. When the cops come up to you, don't run. Whether you're innocent or not, you run. Sure sign that you know. The cop is going to think you did something wrong. Now they're going to chase you. Now when they catch you, they're out of breath. They're pissed off because they got to chase you. Okay? And so somebody is going to get hurt. Won't be the cop.
In Rhode Island, police in Providence have been in the spotlight because of a couple of incidents. There was the shooting death of a black police officer who wasn't in uniform. He was shot by two white officers back in 2000. This year, a black man being questioned at the police department shot and killed a white detective. Are these thoughts on your mind as you work on these issues?
Yes, they are. In some cases, when we do these scenarios across the country, we run those particular types of scenarios so that both law enforcement and community can see what did happen and what could have happened.
I'm wondering if, for instance, a citizen was in the position put in a some sort of skit in the position of those two white officers, found themselves targeting, you know, raising a fake gun, if you will, at a black police officer, they might better understand how that might happen.
What we have seen is that when we put people of color in those two positions, that there is a little more hesitation on firing.
In other words,
not by a whole lot, but a little more hesitation.
On firing at an unknown man who, it turns out, will be a black police officer.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to ask you, I cited the Justice Department report that showed that while minorities are pulled over in about the same numbers as whites, it also found minorities are treated worse once they're pulled over.
That's correct.
That second portion of the study was crossed out of a press release by administration officials who then demoted the head of the Bureau of Statistics because he refused to remove it himself. People, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it's my way of looking at this is that if you've got an 800-pound gorilla banging up and down on your back, it's about time that you recognize the gorilla is real.
Yeah. Lieutenant, have you ever been profiled?
Let's put it this way. When I go in the stores with my wife and family, I keep my hands in my pockets. When I'm driving, I try to maintain the speed limits. When I get stopped, the first thing out of my mouth is, this is my driver's license, this is my insurance card, this is my registration. If they press any further, then I identify myself as a law enforcement officer.
Lieutenant Charles Wilson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Lieutenant Wilson is president of the Rhode Island Minority Police Association, vice president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. For more on his workshops, go to our website, here-now.org. This program note tomorrow on Here and Now, identical twin sisters, one a physician, the other forced to drop out of medical school because of schizophrenia. Both sisters will tell us what happens when your mirror image shatters. That's tomorrow. Comic Chris Elliott is still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now.
The 2006 Farmer's Almanac predicts the East Coast is in for a brutal winter with plenty of snow and frigid temperatures. Consumers are already facing soaring oil prices. Now the federal government predicts that natural gas prices could boost home heating bills by nearly 50%, and some experts agree that could add up to the most expensive winter on record. Vahan Janjigian is executive director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. Vahan, why are natural gas prices going through the roof?
Well, pretty much for the same reasons that oil prices are going through the roof, and that's because demand is strong, supply is limited. We've had hurricane damage in the Gulf of Mexico, which is a major area of production. It's a supply-demand type of thing.
And remind us, where do we get natural gas primarily?
Well, mostly from the United States. We only import approximately 3% because natural gas is very difficult to transport. You can't just put it onto tankers like you can oil. You have to actually lower the temperature to a very, very cold temperature in order to turn it into a liquid before you can put it on a tanker to transport it. So as a result, we can't really rely too much on imports right now because the technology isn't really there. Although in the future, I think that's going to be the trend as we build more LNG terminals around the country.
And right now there are only 4 LNG terminals in the country, one here in Massachusetts. But tell us, we know that agencies that help low-income people have asked Congress to more than double the amount of assistance money in the budget this year for people who can't afford their own gas heat. How are natural gas companies also trying to help consumers?
Well, you know, you may have noticed for years that when you get your gas bill, there's often a slip of paper in there or a statement in there that asks you to make a contribution to a fund that the gas company runs itself, and the money is used to help the customers that are having trouble paying their bills. So they're asking the people who are better off to be able to help the others. I think you're going to see a lot more emphasis on that this year.
Well, you know, and some consumers would say, why? I mean, you know, where is the problem that gas companies have to ask consumers to help other consumers? Is there not enough gas to go around? What's wrong with the supply?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the natural gas industry was deregulated in the 1970s, and deregulation worked in the sense that it really brought down prices. The problem with that is that when prices are very low, the companies don't really have much incentive to spend a lot of money on exploration and drilling. They only like to do these things when prices are high because then it's profitable to do so. Now prices are very high, and if they remain at elevated levels, I think you'll see a lot more of that activity happening. In the long run, we'll be able to get more natural gas. In the short run, though, we're going to be in trouble.
Well, and even in the long run, there are people who are resistant to drilling in their backyard. In Florida, for instance, there's a move against drilling for more natural gas there. Meantime, half of all U.S. homes now use natural gas for heat. But homeowners aren't the only ones taking a hit. Companies use it as well to make products. So how is that going to affect consumers?
Well, it's going to affect consumers. It's going to affect companies. Companies are going to have tighter profit margins. They're going to try to pass on the cost to consumers. They may not always be successful if they're in a competitive environment, but prices to consumers will go up. We'll see greater inflation. You know, let me also point out that there's another source of demand here for this natural gas. Natural gas is considered a very clean source of energy. So over the years, many electric utility companies have been using natural gas to produce electricity.
So that cost will go up as well.
Right.
Some economists predict that with the high natural gas prices, the U.S. could be pushed into a recession. Do you think that will happen? And do you necessarily think that's a bad thing? Some analysts are saying, well, a recession means people spend less, which means companies make less things and use less natural gas, which would bring down the price.
Well, you know, I would never say that a recession would be a good thing, although it's certainly true that a recession would reduce demand tremendously. At this point, I don't think we're in danger of going into a recession. However, I do believe that rising natural gas prices are much more worrisome than rising gasoline prices. We've already seen that the higher price of gasoline has resulted in decreased demand, and that's because people can drive less if they really want to. With natural gas, it's a little bit different. I mean, you really feel the pain if you have to turn down that thermostat, and it's a lot more difficult to do so.
Vahan Janjigian is executive director of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. Vahan, thanks as always for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You may know comedian Chris Elliott as the man under the floor on The David Letterman Show, or the 30-year-old paperboy on the sitcom Get a Life. But you may not be as familiar with Chris Elliott, historical detective, researcher of 19th-century cold cases, such as that of Jack the Thwacker, a serial killer who terrorized New York City in the 1800s, and is tracked in Chris's book by an intrepid team, including, who knew, Teddy Roosevelt, recast as the mayor.
The third member of the team was their friend, the bombastic and thick-headed mayor of New York City, Teddy Roosevelt, who, by all accounts, was fond of bellowing out bully at the top of his lungs, perhaps even to excess. But history has forgotten that the well-educated and world-traveled man also coined a number of other popular phrases, such as, don't go there, I'm a happy camper, why don't you just apply it directly to your thighs? In addition, he was famous for exclaiming wee-hoo in falsetto whenever an embarrassing wind escaped his trousers.
That's Chris Elliott reading from his first novel, The Shroud of the Thwacker, a wacky parallel universe version of Patricia Cornwell's Portrait of a Killer, Jack the Ripper, Case Closed, with perhaps a satiric swipe as well at Dan Brown's ridiculously best-selling The Da Vinci Code. Elliott's book references The Mummers, Hellman's Mayonnaise, The Great Chicago Fire, which he moves to Lower Manhattan, Yoko Ono, and time travel, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Chris Elliott joins us in the studio. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me.
What were you thinking?
I also danced with the Alvin Ailey Dance Company.
Oh, yeah, that's
you.
In there, too.
Okay, good.
Why? What was this? What inspired this?
Well, you say, the truth is I'm a fan of that genre, of the historical mystery thriller. I thought it would be fun to do a history book about New York City without doing any research on it. And then I thought, well, you know, that would be a coffee table book. But what I'd like to do is sort of write a story. And so I sort of combined, you know, Patricia Cornwell's books and these historical thrillers and put them all together. And this book kind of, it's a historical thriller that I've, you know, that takes place in 1882. But I've kind of combined everything that I think of when I think of the turn of the century or the turn of that century.
Oh, really? Were cell phones there?
They were. They were wooden, though.
That's right.
And they were powered by gas.
And there's a fellow who sells Hellman's mayonnaise on the corner.
Well, Hellman had just invented mayonnaise, but he wasn't sure how to market it at this point. So he sold it. It was sold on the street corners like hot dogs are today. Mm. But, you know, people were happy to eat it out of a cup with a spoon.
Chris, I think mayonnaise came from France.
I'm sorry. I watched the History Channel a couple of times, but that is about the only research I did.
Well, that's some summary. Can you tell us more? There's this Jack the Thwacker.
That's right.
By the way, any concern about making, you know, grisly killings of prostitutes the centerpiece of your satire?
Well, that was the challenge. It's dark humor. There's no doubt about it. But the fun of the book, I think, is the sort of historic stuff as opposed to that. And there's a reason that he does, do things to these prostitutes that is actually paid off at the end.
Yes, there is. And we're not
Jack the Ripper had no reason to.
That's
but the
right.
Thwacker actually really has a good reason.
And we won't give away that ending. But can we also share? It gives you an opportunity to come up with what you think a price index for a prostitute might be in the 1800s. Would you read
sure.
that there?
Sure.
It begins with
to.
A quick bibble in the old bauble.
Yeah, that's where it begins, which is on 10th Avenue, old Toothless Sally had finally gotten it together and was out hawking her goods. Hello, Governor. Care for a quick bibble in the old bauble? A quick bibble in the old bauble cost an even sixpence, while a wet waggle cost a halfpenny or two. A fish in a dish with tartar sauce on the side was a full tuppence, and if someone wanted an all-night dilly wonker or a triple wraparound digger, that was extra, and Sally always made it clear up front that she wasn't into anything weird.
Why is that funny?
I don't know. It's sick. You shouldn't be laughing at that.
Okay. So this is one of the poor women who meets her.
That's
meets
the
her
first
end.
One.
Yes.
Yes.
And on...
They're all named after ex-girlfriends. Go on.
Really?
No.
Okay. On the trail of Jack the Thwacker are these three. We have Caleb Spencer, who's a police chief. We have Evening...
Of the NCNYPD, not to interrupt, which stands for 19th Century New York Police Department.
Evening Post reporter Liz Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Any relation to the modern day?
Well, you know, that on the surface, that may look like I'm making a comment about how old Liz Smith is nowadays. But all I can say is there is time travel involved in this book. So and she actually comes off pretty good. The only person still living from 1882 actually today is Don Imus. Okay.
And then there's Mayor Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Everything in the book eventually ties to the Mummers. Is this sort of a backhand tribute to Dan Brown? Because we remind people, in his book, Angels and Demons, he talks about the secret society of the Illuminati.
Right. And the Knights Templar and all that. In my book, it's like the Friars Club and the Knights of Columbus and the most mysterious of all, which is the Mummers. but that's about it. It's not really a parody of those books. And that's actually my only sort of I think maybe the Divine Feminine makes some appearance at the end. But that's pretty much my only reference to Dan Brown's work.
An homage, perhaps.
An homage. And actually, to be honest with you, I do love those books. And I don't think you can parody or have fun with something unless you really like what you're making fun of.
In reading it, I can see a young Gene Wilder. Playing
that's
the police
so funny that you would bring that up, because I did sort of feel like when I was writing that. I mean, Young Frankenstein was one of my favorite movies of all times. The whole time writing this book, I was thinking of it as a movie. Not that it would ever be made into one, but and Gene Wilder would have been in that.
Of course, another character in the book is Chris Elliott.
Well, I got like halfway through the book and I realized I wasn't in it. And I thought, well, what if it is a movie?
You want to be.
I'd like to be in it, yes.
Right. So there you are. I would miss it without you. how important is it to be?
For my fans, I think it's important. I think I may have, with this book, maybe I didn't need to be in it necessarily, but I felt starting out that, I'd like to have some part in it just because it was a fun world that I was creating.
Chris Elliott, you have your own quiet life in Connecticut, married, 2 children. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier.
And I have a family in Montana also, raising.
That's sort of illegal, so let's. But you said to me that in some ways you might be following in the footsteps of your dad, Bob Elliott, of Bob and Ray fame, the super comedy team from the 50s and 60s.
I think that on the surface, our humor, by the way, looks completely different, although my dad loves this book and we, I think we have the same sense of humor. But it seems I have the same kind of career. I have an even-keeled career that's never had huge highs, but has never had bottom out lows either. Mm-hmm. There was a week after Cabin Boy came out. But other than that, I've been pretty much able to make my nut every year. And I'm lucky enough to have people call and say, will you play this guy or will you do this or that, and have time to, do something that I'm passionate about, like this novel.
And that's funny because when I, I'm a huge fan of your dad as well, who started here in Boston with Ray on Boston
HGH.
Radio at HGH Radio. But when I do think of him and when I think of you, I think, now there are some dependable comics.
Well, that's sweet to hear. Thank you. I'm not a fan of my dad's work. But other than that, I agree with you.
Chris Elliott, his new book is called, his first novel is called The Shroud of the Thwacker. And perhaps will be a movie down the road starring Chris Elliott.
Yeah.
Chris,
the guy from Sideways.
Chris, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Robin.
Chris Elliott does look a little like Paul Giamatti. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.